Welcome to episode 4 of the Academic Podcast. I am Sam McLean, I am your host, and today I have an interview with Professor Kevin James of the University of Guelph. As per usual, I will let my guest introduce himself. So please go ahead.
Well, I'm Kevin James. I have been a faculty member here at the University of Guelph for over 15 years, and my areas of specialization here are 19th century Britain and Ireland. I have interests in social and cultural history, and in particularly right now in the history of travel.
Very cool. So we'll just start with the list of questions. Why or how did you become a historian?
I had no intention of becoming a historian in my undergraduate years. I had every intention of going on into law, and it was the influence and example of several of the instructors that I had at McGill University in my undergraduate years that made me think of history as a field of endeavor, as an area of inquiry, and the profession as one that would interest me, and one that I followed through with a master's. Even after my master's, it wasn't clear to me that I'd want to go on to do a PhD, but it whetted my appetite for research.
So how did you decide to do a PhD?
Well, there were questions raised in my master's that I wanted to pursue in greater depth, in particular ideas of socioeconomic status, the experience of the Irish, in particular the Irish Protestant community in Montreal. And, well, as I say, the MA whetted my appetite. I didn't feel like I really had the opportunity to explore it at the level that a PhD would offer. And so that led me to a PhD, in particular with a faculty member whom I identified during my MA at the University of Edinburgh and with whom I had made contact, who proved to be a superb supervisor, too, in the Department of Economic and Social History there.
Edinburgh is a lovely town.
It is, and it was a wonderful place to do a degree.
So as historians, we apply various labels to ourselves, both in terms of what we study, the types of questions we ask. So are these labels important?
I think that they can help to orient us towards a community of like-minded scholars. They can help to promote exchange and dialogues within that community and between communities of scholars. But I wouldn't want to think that any label is an exclusionary or indeed an exclusive label. I think that also we can migrate from where an area of interest or one set of methodologies over the course of a project, to say nothing of a career.
Absolutely.
And so I consider them helpful, but I wouldn't want to adopt them in too restrictive a way.
In terms of the effect on the academic community, have you found that they can be more beneficial or more harmful in terms of the interaction of communities?
Well, it depends, I suppose, on the particular label. Right now, I would wear the hat of a historian of tourism and travel, and there's something that's inherently kind of Catholic about that area of inquiry.
Sorry, by Catholic, you mean universal?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just to clarify.
Which brings literary scholars, anthropologists, sociologists, and others together from many disciplines, but also brings within the discipline of history, economic historians, cultural historians, and social historians into dialogue. So I kind of prefer it as a label right now because it doesn't denote any particular methodology, but it denotes a particular area of primary inquiry that can be nourished by all of these other approaches.
Leads very well into the next question. So history isn't really just about memorizing facts or teaching facts. It's also about learning or teaching historical process. In your teaching experience, how do you balance between teaching things that happened and teaching your students how to be historians?
Well, I mean, I'm someone who thinks content really does matter. And I feel that the best way for students to be able to refine their skill set is in the context of a course that is, you know, content heavy in terms of learning about concepts, about theories, and yes, about dates and events and personalities and processes in history. So I would never be someone who would privilege the skill set over the substance of history. But I think in devising assignments, in evaluating students' work, we have to be mindful of the explicit identification of skill sets that they are acquiring as they engage in historical research and writing.
How do you see the transition between undergraduate history education and graduate education? Some things do change and some things don't. And I mean, a master's program can be, you know, there's different ways to do a master's. Sometimes it's just further study on a topic, and sometimes it really is professional training. So how do you see that sort of that pivot between undergrad and grad education?
I think the best undergraduate education will be part of a scaffolding which provides real training, really intensive research opportunities, which lead naturally to graduate level research. And ideally, it would also develop a culture within a department and amongst a student body, which helps to facilitate their progression to graduate study. So in an ideal world, I think that the undergraduate experience, say with the development of a thesis kind of based undergraduate capstone experience, would allow students to evaluate whether further study is something that would interest them. If not, it becomes a capstone in itself. If so, it prepares them, I think, for the culture of graduate school and for some of the skills and research and writing requirements that graduates expect of them.
So what would you consider to be the basic principles or first concepts of history and historical practice? I mean, in archaeology, you have things like stratigraphy, which is how things are sitting in the ground and things like that.
Well, I think, you know, the sound, careful, meticulous, respectful analysis of primary sources with an appreciation of the context of their creation and equally the context of their preservation and presentation to the historian is the basic building block of the historian's skill set.
And one thing that I've learned quite a bit recently is that history is a collaboration. It must be a collaboration between historians. Not only, you know, you collaborate with your sources to create something original, but you also have to really, even if you're not working with them, you still have to engage with other academics. And this is something that's a skill that is difficult to learn. So how would you advise is the best way to learn how to engage with other academics and become sort of actively be part of the academic community?
Well, I think you begin by reading.
Yep.
You begin by identifying not just the historians with whom you may sympathize, but others too. And I think gaining a sound grasp of the different approaches that historians may take to a topic is a good way to begin. And then I think taking the next step, which is communicating with them, developing some kind of relationship, whether it's over email, whether it's in conferences, whether it's joining networks of historians with like-minded interests. I think that's the way to begin to feel less isolated as a practitioner, and also a way to really nourish the scholarly enterprise.
So I guess part of that is, you know, one of the keys for young career academics is to market themselves or to pick themselves as an expert. I find this to be a little bit problematic because, you know, you have experts who are, if you're an expert baker, you're really good at making bread. If you're an expert on the European Reformations, sometimes that means you know a lot about the little details, and you know, mm-hmm. you might have memorized the contents of an archive. How would you? I guess this is something. I think this is the idea of an expert is something that's changing. So how would you just define or describe what expertise is in terms of academic history?
Well, I think it depends on the audience to whom you're pitching your expertise. if you're pitching to a predominantly academic audience, I think you would self-identify in ways that they would recognize, whether it's your field of inquiry. If it's a wider audience, I think you have to define your expertise in ways that link your historical scholarship to the requirements they may have of you. So, project management, collaboration, research skills, interest in the wider world around you, which is, I think, a characteristic of most of the historians I've met, whether they're first-year undergraduate historians or professional historians. They have a real interest in the wider world. And I think that those are ways that we can define our expertise in that are relatable outside the academy.
All right, you've been portrayed as an expert. You were on Ancestors in the Attic. You were the historical expert. How did you find that as an experience as a historian?
Well, I found it an incredibly gratifying experience, and I found it a very positive experience to be able to, you know, leave the walls of the ivory tower and to, in my own very modest way, because, of course, we're supported by a team of researchers, represent the historical research process to a wider audience. And to me, that was an incredibly gratifying experience.
It's certainly fascinating watching people on TV, whether it's someone like Dan Starkey or when Andrew Lambert gets on TV and talks about the naval history at length. It's interesting to see whether it's them presenting knowledge or them presenting, you know, talking about. It's always interesting when they go, "Oh, I don't know about this." Sometimes you see a historian on TV and it's the antique show in the UK. On the BBC, and they get handed something and they don't know what it is, and so then they go find someone else who does, and it's being able to say this isn't my period, this isn't my topic, but I can help you find someone else who can answer your question, and that doesn't threaten their identity as an expert. I think in some ways it enhances it, because it shows that they are able to ask, and they're also able to show that it shows that they can. They know when they don't have the answers, and then can help find someone who does.
And and related to that, I guess it also demonstrates a certain
Antiques Roadshow is the show I was thinking of. You're absolutely right. It's the finding that skill set.
But it also allows them, I guess, to tap into their own networks, and that in itself is an expertise. To be able to build up relationships in the profession is something that is no small feat.
So, going on from there very nicely, I mean, you've had academic experiences here at McGill and in the UK, in Scotland, at Edinburgh. How would you characterize the differences between the North American academic community and process and the English or Scottish academic community and process?
Well, I think the structure of the PhD is the one that I'm best able to comment on. And, you know, I had an extremely positive experience of my PhD. I liked the fact in the United Kingdom that it is a shorter PhD. I like the emphasis on research from the very start. I mean, there were supportive courses for me to take, but for the most part, I was able to jump into the research as soon as I arrived. And I like the way in which, if you can complete within the prescribed time frame, it allows for the contemplation of career paths beyond the academy. And that was something that I was very seriously contemplating. And, you know, I felt like I had the ability to contemplate in my mid-20s when I completed the PhD. The one here is, of course, longer. It has many merits to it in terms of its preparation of students for teaching through the comprehensive examinations. And in that respect, I think it's a very rigorous and important degree process, but I do recognize the demands that it makes on people, especially through their 20s. It the average length of completion is considerably longer in North America than it is in the UK. And, you know, as I was told by my friends in the UK, it's totally possible upon the completion of a UK PhD to continue the learning experience, something that we all do as academics and we all do generally. The PhD is a credential, but it isn't the end of learning. And those skill sets that perhaps teaching being one example, I hadn't acquired in the to the same extent as North American students often do, I was able to acquire after my PhD.
Did you find it difficult to transition back into Canada after spending that much time in the UK?
I didn't, because I had the good fortune of studying an area that takes me back and forth quite often. And I think that's one of the great privileges of my profession and one of the great privileges of the area in which I study. It means that having also been a student in Canada before I left to do my PhD, I was returning to fairly familiar terrain.
For me, one of the big advantages of the UK is that everything is so much more by everything, I mean, within 4 hours train ride of London, there are many, many, many different universities, not just in England, but in Europe. And this allows for seminar series and conferences and things to be, those kinds of events to be held much more often. Whereas Canada, things are much more spread out, which makes it, unfortunately, a lot more expensive, frankly, to have those kinds of academic communities, or academic events. But the internet is changing this. Things like Twitter, and maybe not so much Facebook, but certainly Twitter or academia.edu, it's changing how historians can, or not just historians, but it's academics around the world and across various disciplines can interact with each other. And I don't think you have a Twitter account.
Personally. I don't.
How do you see the internet as the... Because before, you were talking about students having discussions online and that being something that was very troublesome to look after when you're teaching an online course. So how do you see the internet and these kinds of tools changing, not just academia, but really academic communication?
Well, I guess there are two ways in which it has really changed academic communication. One is that it has brought so many more of our sources to us.
Yeah.
The primary source is now at our fingertips, whereas before, in many, many, many cases, we had to travel long distances to reach them. And I think that's an entirely salutary development. It does, however, impact on our capacity to network in the archives if we visit the archives less. I mean, the archives are still places of critical importance because they're, for the most part, helping to make the public access to documents so much more widespread. But my impression of the potential for the internet to become a tool for building networks and communities is entirely positive. I haven't engaged in it as much as I would like, as much as I see some of my younger colleagues doing.
What's holding you back from, say, jumping into Twitter?
Right now, time, I'd say. And making sure that I, in my own way, have something to say that is substantial and substantive and makes substantial, I say, when I have it's 140 characters, I have to be very careful.
You wouldn't about how fill I parse your feed with cat photos.
No,
academic cats, hashtag.
No, though I have used, there's a great Twitter account devoted to history jokes and jokes about historians that I use a lot in class. So, to me, it's just adjusting to the culture of it. And partly that's me learning the expectations and kind of the codes that govern behavior in those kind of forums. And that, I guess, begins to date me as a middle-aged historian, but someone who's not by any means hostile to that environment, but open to learning its the protocols and codes associated with it.
You're talking about the archives. Traditionally, there's the approach where, someone takes a 2-week research trip. They go to Kew, wherever, the county archives. They spend their entire trip from time, they open the doors, you walk in, you walk out when they lock the doors, taking photos, scribbling mm-hmm. notes on primary sources. Now, when I was doing my research, I'd go to Oxford for a day, take 1,500, 2,000 photos, and, I'd go through 6 or 7 volumes, just take photos of every single page, and then go home and then start reading through the sources at home, in comfortable settings, or you can, there's sources online where you can download entire volumes of just volumes of letters. There are things like British History Online where they've just put books of the state calendars, or state papers and other things online. I think there is the ability now for researchers to acquire or to find a much higher volume of data, of sources. I mean, I have 40-something odd gigs of primary source archives. That's a lot of photos at 2 or 3 megs per photo. And in the end, I'm drowning in my sources. Do you think that... I'm not sure how much you used for your PhD thesis, but do you think that the ability to acquire so much more information is going to change how, in particular, the PhD works?
It might change the place in which we begin to sift through that data. Certainly, I didn't have a camera that I was able to use when I was doing my PhD research, so I did spend weeks on end in archives, arriving when they opened and leaving when we were kicked out. And that was partly an experience of adjudicating the value of particular records, as well as taking manuscript notes of those records. Now, like you, I find it much more efficient to take photographs of them because they are much, much, much easier to work with in Canada if they're records from the UK. But it does give me the luxury of time when I return home to be able to read them, assess them, work with them, cite them properly, which was an issue I often encountered if I wasn't able to read my chicken scratch when I returned back from the archives. So all in all, I consider it a very positive thing that we're able to use these devices now in the archives. And my own experience is that I'm just doing the same sort of decision-making, selection, and adjudication of records. I'm just able to take more time to do it when I'm at home.
Chris Madsen, who's the president of the Canadian Nautical Research Society, he has bought something like 10 or 15 of the same model of camera. And he takes them to, when he goes to the archive, he'll take 3 or 4 of them with him. Because when he wears them out, it's just, he takes so many photos, he actually wears out the camera mechanism. And so he's figured it out that it's much more cost efficient to just buy it. You know, they're 5-year-old cameras. They're not top of the line. But it's so much more cost efficient just to take the camera, wear it out, and replace it and keep on going with your photos. I mean, he doesn't do it every time. But I find it really interesting that the way that we do primary source research is now much, much more about being able to acquire so much more data that the sifting through of it really becomes problematic. And I certainly didn't learn enough about that when I was doing my master's. You know, my master supervisor handed me a diary and said, here's a really good source. And then that became the basis for my master's thesis. Mm-hmm. And when I started my PhD, it was, well, I have all this legislation. That's right here. I know what acts are about the Navy. It became very simple for me. And then I went to the archives and there was, 400 volumes of ADM/1 or whatever it is, and it becomes a lot more difficult to figure out how much of every type of source you need mm-hmm. to actually get the information you're looking for.
Well, it's amazing that, when I was looking at parliamentary papers in the UK, I was dealing with the actual 19th century volumes that were held in archives. And I compare that to today, 20 years later almost, and I can easily pull them up on a laptop.
Makes work so much easier.
I think so. I really do. Although I do accept the argument, the contention that we may be drowning in our sources now. But it's a pleasant thing to have, I think, as opposed to being in an archive with a limited amount of time, limited resources, including a budget, and having to make decisions also about which items would be photocopied. I recall that with a certain amount of money and 30p or 50p per copy, I had to be very, very, very judicious in my selections. And sometimes I made mistakes in the sources I chose, and I don't have to worry about that error anymore.
So just a couple questions left. What would you say are areas that are things that concern you in terms of the future of academia or the future of history?
I think that, the larger position of history within the academy is one that currently is under debate. I think it's a healthy debate to have. I think that's one important consequence of the debate that we're engaged in about history and history's contribution to the intellectual formation of students at the undergraduate and graduate levels is we're having to look carefully at the specific skill sets that students do acquire in the course of their studies, and also do maybe revision aspects of our curriculum, and to be, as I mentioned earlier, much more explicit about the skill sets that they acquire in the course of history classes. And I think that's a very positive thing. But this debate about the value of history and the value of the humanities in the context of a vocational focus is one that occasionally concerns me. That would be the discourse surrounding our discipline, the wider discourse that I find most discouraging. But I also recall, in terms of the future of the profession, when I began my master's, we were issued dire warnings about the state of the profession, in particular the likelihood that there would be very few jobs available when we graduated. And when I did graduate, I was amongst the first of a wave of new recruits into this department and into the history departments generally in Canada and in the wider English-speaking world, which makes me think that perhaps we're not as good as we are in relating the past in terms of predicting the future.
There is hope for future PhDs.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
So the last question today is, what have you read recently, or whose work recently is inspiring you?
I'm working right now in the field of hotel history, and as a kind of a sub-area of tourism history. And what has amazed me is the quality of work on hotels in the past 10 years. So, you know, there's been recent work in the past 6 or 7 years by people like Molly Berger on the American Hotel, but there's also A.K. Sandoval Strauss's work on the history of the American Hotel, much of which helped to place the hotel in a kind of international context, which draw very heavily on sociology, philosophy, history of technology, social history, and have really helped to convince me of the merits of studying the hotel as a social, cultural, and commercial institution.
That's very cool. So this is the opportunity I give all my guests to plug their own projects. So what would you like to plug today?
Well, my most recent publication, and it's now 2 years old, 2014, is Tourism, Land, and Landscape in Ireland, The Commodification of Culture by Routledge. However, I'm engaging in a new set of projects, as I say, centered on the history of the hotel. And I'm particularly looking at hotel books, visitors' books from hotels in the Victorian period. And I'm looking at them principally in the United Kingdom, but also in the Republic of Ireland. And for me, this has been a fascinating entree into the world of the traveler and the guest. And subsequent to my work in the archives on visitors' books, because relating to our previous discussion, I've photographed, you know, thousands of pictures of visitors' books, so now I have to start sifting through them. But I've turned my attention to the legislation that governed the hotel in wartime. So I imagine that in the next year or two, I will begin to think of a project that looks at the status of the hotel, the legal status of the hotel, the political, diplomatic, economic, and other roles of the hotel in wartime. And I suspect that my project will cohere around the British hotel in the First World War.
And they'll be able to follow you at your profile on the University of Guelph website?
And who knows, they may be on Twitter. Else? Yeah, maybe Twitter as well.
Certainly I'll advise you to join. I will say definitely join Twitter. I will promote you to everybody I know.
Thanks very much, Sam.
So I want to thank again Professor Kevin James for being here and doing this with me. We'll look forward to the next episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.